Side 3, Azazel by Isaac Asimov. Continuing with The Evil Drink Does on page 85. I did not see much of Ishtar at that time, you understand. She was very busy. Yet I could see she was consuming the supply of Nubal men at a fearful rate. Soon or later, she would have to extend her range. It was sooner. She met me one morning as she was about to leave for the airport. She was more Zoftig than ever, more pneumatic, more startling in all possible measurements. Nothing of what she had gone through seemed to have affected her, except for the more and better. She pulled a bottle out of her purse. "Rum," she said. "They drink that down in the Caribbean, and it's a very mild and very pleasant beverage." "Are you going to the Caribbean, dear?" "Oh, yes, and elsewhere. The men at home seem to be of poor endurance and weak spirit. I am very disappointed in them, although there have been moments of high adventure. I am very grateful to you, George, for making it possible. It seems to have begun when you first introduced me to that peppermint squash. It seems a shame that you and I haven't..." "Nonsense, dear girl. I work for humanity, you know. I never think of myself at all." She placed a kiss upon my cheek that burned like sulfuric acid, and she was gone. I mopped my brow in considerable relief, but I did flatter myself that for once my application to Azazel had brought about something that had ended happily. For Ishtar, who through inheritance was independently wealthy, could now indulge indefinitely and without harm in her artless enthusiasms for alcoholic and masculinic pleasures. Or so I thought. It was not until more than a year had passed that I heard from her again. She was back in town, and she phoned me. It was a while before I realized who it was. She was hysterical.
"My life is over," she screamed at me. "Even my mother no longer loves me. I can't understand how it happened, but I'm sure it's your fault. If you had not introduced me to that peppermint squash, I just know that nothing like this would ever have happened."
"But what has happened, my dear?" I asked, trembling. An Ishtar who was furious with me would not be an Ishtar it would be safe to approach.
"You come here. I'll show you."
My curiosity will someday be the end of me. On that occasion, it nearly was. I couldn't resist going to her mansion on the outskirts of town. Wisely, I left the front door open behind me. When she approached with a butcher knife, I turned and fled with a speed that I would have been proud of in my younger days. Fortunately, she was in no position to follow, considering her condition. She left again, shortly afterward, and as far as I know, has not returned since. I live in dread that someday she will. The Ishtar mystics of this world do not forget. George seemed to think he had come to the end of the story.
"But what had happened?" I asked.
"You don't see. Her body chemistry had been adjusted to convert alcohol very efficiently to the 2-carbon fragment that was the crossroads of carbohydrate, fat, and protein metabolism. Alcohol was to her a healthful food. And she drank like a 6-foot sponge, incredibly. And all of it slid down the metabolic chain to the 2-carbon fragment, and from that, up the metabolic chain to fat. She had, in a word, become stout. In 2 words, grossly obese. All that gorgeous beauty had expanded and exploded into layer upon layer of lard." George shook his head in mingled horror and regret and said, "The evil drink does would be hard to assess." Writing time. George said, "I once knew someone a little like you. We had a window seat at the small restaurant where we were having lunch, and George was looking out pensively. I said, 'That's astonishing. I should have thought I was unique.' 'You are,' said George. 'The man I'm referring to was only a little like you. For the ability to scribble, scribble, scribble while keeping the brain totally detached, you stand alone.' 'Actually,' I said, 'I use a word processor.' 'I use the word scribble,' said George loftily, 'in what a real writer would understand as the metaphorical sense.'" Then he paused over his chocolate mousse to sigh dramatically. I knew the sign. "You're going to tell me one of your flights of fancy concerning Azazel, aren't you, George?" He looked at me scornfully.
You've been flying your own fancy so long and so limply, you don't know the ring of truth when you hear it. But never mind, it is too sad a tale to tell you. Except that you're going to anyway, aren't you? George sighed again. It's that bus stop out there, said George, that reminds me of Mordecai Sims, who made a moderate living for himself by turning out endless reams of variegated trash. Not as much as you do, of course, and not as trashy, which is why he is only a little like you. To do him justice, I occasionally read some of his material and found them quite so-so. Without meaning to hurt your feelings, you've never reached that mark, at least according to reports, for I have never been quite low enough in my mind to read you myself. Mordecai was different from you in another respect. He was terribly impatient. Observe yourself in the mirror over there, assuming you have no objection to being reminded of what you look like, and see how you sit here carelessly, one arm thrown over the back of the chair and the rest of you slumped into casual shapelessness. One would never think, to look at you, that you had any concern as to whether your daily quota of randomly typed paper would be turned out or not. Mordecai was not like that. He was always conscious of his deadlines, behind which he was in perpetual danger of falling. I lunched with him regularly every Tuesday in those days, and he tended to make the experience a hideous one with his chatter. "I've got to have that piece in the mail by tomorrow morning at the latest," he would say. "And I've got to do a bit of revision on another piece first, and I just don't have the time. Where the devil is that check? Why doesn't the waiter show up? What do they do with themselves in the kitchen? Have swimming contests in the gravy?" He was always particularly impatient with respect to the check, and I would fear that he might bolt, leaving it behind for me to evade, somehow. To do him justice, that never happened, but the feeling that it might tended to spoil the meal. Or look at that bus stop out there. I have been observing it for 15 minutes. You'll notice that no bus has come, and that it is a windy day with a late fall nip to the air. What we see are collars turned up, hands thrust into pockets, noses turning red or blue, feet being shuffled for warmth. What we don't see is any rebellion in the ranks, any fists waved angrily to heaven. All those waiting there are broken into passivity by the injustice of life. Not Mordecai Sims. If he were in that bus line, he would be dashing out into the road to survey the distant horizon for any sign of a vehicle. He would be growling and snarling and waving his arms. He would be urging a mass march on City Hall. He would, in short, be depleting his adrenal glands. Many's the time he turned to me with his complaints, attracted, as so many are, by my cool air of competence and understanding. "I am a busy man, George," he would say rapidly. He always talked rapidly. "It's a shame, a scandal and a crime, the way the world conspires against me. I had to drop in at a hospital for some routine tests. God knows why, except that my doctor foolishly thinks he has to make a living. And I was told to arrive at 9:40 a.m. at such and such a desk. I got there at 9:40 a.m. precisely, of course, and on the desk in question was a sign saying, 'Open for business at 9:30 a.m.' That is what it said, George, in English without a letter out of place. Behind the desk, however, there was no one. I checked my watch and said to someone who looked hangdog enough to be a hospital attendant, 'Where,' I said, 'is the nameless villain who should be behind that desk?' 'Not here yet,' said the low-born knave. 'It says this place is open for business at 9:30 a.m.' 'Someone will be here sooner or later, I guess,' he answered with a vicious indifference. It was, after all, a hospital. I might be dying. Did anyone care? No. I had a deadline looming for an important item I had expended half my guts on, something that would earn me enough money to pay my doctor's bill, assuming I had nothing better to spend it on, which wasn't likely. Did anyone care? No. It was not until 10:04 that someone showed up, and when I rushed to the desk, that belated devil stared at me haughtily and said, 'You'll have to wait your turn.'" Mordecai was full of stories like that, of banks of elevators in which every single one was moving slowly upward while he waited in the lobby, of people who lunched from 12 to 3:30 and began their four-day weekends on Wednesday whenever he needed to consult them. "I don't see why anyone bothered to invent time, George," he would say. "It's just a device to make possible the formation of novel methods of wastage. Do you realize that if I could convert the hours I must spend waiting on the convenience of assorted malapert varlets into writing time for myself, I could increase my output by anywhere from 10 to 20%. Do you further realize that, despite the criminal parsimony of publishers, that would mean a corresponding increase in my income? Where is that miserable check? I could not help but think it would be a kindly deed to help him increase his income, since he had the good taste to spend some of it on me. What's more, he had a way of selecting first-class places at which to dine, and that warmed my heart. No, not like this one, old fellow. Your taste falls far short of what it ought to be, as I am told one can tell from your writing. I therefore began to stir my powerful mind for ways to help him. I did not immediately think of Azazel. In those days, I had not yet grown accustomed to him. After all, a 2-centimeter-tall demon is a little out of the ordinary. Eventually, though, it occurred to me to wonder whether Azazel could do anything about building up someone's writing time. It didn't seem likely, and I might be just wasting his time. But what's time to an otherworldly creature? I went through the necessary routine of ancient spells and incantations to call him forth from wherever it is he comes, and he arrived asleep. His tiny eyes were closed, and there was a high-pitched hum coming from him that rose and fell in an irregular and unpleasant fashion. It may have been the equivalent of a human snore. I wasn't sure how one went about waking him, and finally I decided to allow a drop of water to fall on his stomach. He had a perfectly spherical abdomen, you know, as though he had swallowed a ball bearing. I haven't the slightest idea of whether that is the norm on his world, but once when I mentioned it, he demanded to know what a ball bearing was, and then, when I explained, he threatened to zapolniclate me. I didn't know what that meant, but from the tone of his voice I gathered it was something unpleasant. The drop of water did wake him, and he was absurdly annoyed, too. He kept talking about having been half-drowned, and went into tedious detail as to the proper method of waking one up on his world. It was something about dancing and flower petals and soft musical instruments and the touch of the fingers of gorgeous dancing maidens. I told him that on our world we just played garden hoses on each other, and he made some remark about ignorant barbarians, and eventually cooled down sufficiently to allow me to talk sense to him. I explained the situation, and I rather thought that, without more ado, he would say a few words of gibberish, and that would be that. He did no such thing. Instead, he looked grave and said,
"See here, you are asking me to interfere with the laws of probability."
I was pleased that he had grasped the situation. "Exactly," I said.
"But that's not easy," he said.
"Of course not," I said. "Would I ask you to do it if it were easy? If it were easy, I'd do it myself. It's only when it's not easy that I have to call on someone as magnificently superior as yourself." Nauseating, of course, but essential when you deal with a demon who is as sensitive about his height as about his ball-bearing belly. He looked gratified at my logic and said,
"Well, I don't say it's impossible."
"Good."
"It would require an adjustment of the gin-whipper continuum of your world."
"Exactly. You took the words out of my mouth."
"What I will have to do is introduce a few nodes in the interconnection of the continuum with your friend, the one with the deadlines." "What are deadlines, by the way?"
I tried to explain, and he said with a windy little suspiration,
"Ah, yes. We have such things in our more ethereal demonstrations of affection. Allow a deadline to pass, and the dear little creatures never let you hear the end of it. I remember once..."
But I will spare you the sordid details of his insignificant sex life.
"The only thing is," he said finally, "that once I introduce the nodes, I won't be able to undo them."
"Why not?" Azazel said with elaborate casualness,
"Theoretically impossible, I'm afraid."
I didn't believe that at all. It was just that the miserable little incompetent didn't know how. Still, since he was quite competent enough to make life impossible for me, I did not let him know I had seen through his charade, but simply said, "You won't have to undo it. Mordecai is after additional writing time, and once he has it, he will be satisfied for life."
"In that case, I shall do it."
For a long time, he made passes. It looked like something a magician would do, except that his hand seemed to flicker and turn invisible now and then for shorter or longer intervals. They were so small, to be sure, it was hard to tell whether they were visible or not, even under normal circumstances. "What are you doing?" I asked. But Azazel shook his head, and his lips moved as though he were counting. Then, apparently finished, he lay back on the table and panted. I said, "Is it done?" He nodded and said,
"I hope you realize I had to lower his entropy quotient more or less permanently."
"What does that mean?"
"It means that things will be a little more orderly in his neighborhood than one should suspect."
"Nothing wrong with being orderly," I said. "You might not think it, old fellow, but I have always believed in being orderly. I keep an accurate list of every cent I owe you. The details are on innumerable scraps of paper that are here and there in my apartment. You can have them any time you want them." Azazel said,
"Of course there's nothing wrong with being orderly. It's just that you can't really defy the second law of thermodynamics. It means that things will be a little less orderly elsewhere in order to restore the balance."
"In what way?" I said, checking my zipper. One can never be too careful.
"In various ways, mostly unnoticeable. I've spread the effect through the solar system, so that there will be a few more asteroid collisions than would ordinarily take place, a few more eruptions on Io, and so on. Mostly, it's the sun that will be affected."
"How?"
"I estimate it will get hot enough to make life on Earth impossible about 2.5 million years sooner than it would have before I noted the continuum."
I shrugged. "What are a few million years when it's a question of having someone pick up my dinner checks with that cheerful disposition one likes to see?" It was about a week afterward that I once again dined with Mordecai. He seemed rather excited as he checked his coat, and when he arrived at the table, where I was waiting patiently with my drink, he smiled brilliantly.
"George," he said, "what an unusual week I have had."
He held his hand up without looking, and did not seem at all surprised when a menu was placed in it. Mind you, this was a restaurant at which the waiters, a haughty and imperious lot, gave out no menus without an application in triplicate that had been countersigned by the manager. Mordecai said,
"George, everything has been going like clockwork."
I suppressed a smile.
"Indeed?" "When I walk into the bank, there's an empty window and a smiling cashier. When I walk into the post office, there's an empty window and..." "Well, I guess you wouldn't actually expect a post office employee to smile, but at least he registered a letter of mine with scarcely any snarl at all. The buses drive up as I arrive, and I barely had my hand up in yesterday's rush hour when a taxi swerved and stopped for me. A checker cab, too. When I asked to be taken to 5th and 49th, he took me there, showing every sign he knew the layout of the streets of the city. He even spoke English. What would you like to have, George?"
A glance at the menu was sufficient. Apparently, it was arranged that even I should not delay him. Mordecai then tossed his menu to one side and proceeded to give the order for both of us rapidly. I noticed that he did not look up to see whether a waiter was actually at his side. He had already grown accustomed to assume one would be. And one was. The waiter rubbed his hands together, bowed, and proceeded to serve the meal with celerity, grace, and efficiency. I said, "You do seem to be having the most amazing streak of luck, Mordecai, my friend. How do you account for it?" I must admit that I had a passing thought that I might make him believe I was responsible. After all, if he knew that, would he not surely shower me with gold, or, in these debased times, with paper? "Simple," he said, tucking his napkin into his shirt collar and seizing his knife and fork in a death grip, for Mordecai, with all his virtues, was not one of your dainty feeders. "It's not luck at all. It's the inevitable result of the workings of chance."
"Of chance?" I said indignantly.
Mordecai said, "Certainly. I have spent my whole life enduring the most miserable series of fortuitous delays that the world has ever seen. The laws of chance make it necessary that such an unbroken fund of misfortune be made up for. And that's what's happening now, and should continue to be happening for the rest of my life. I expect it to. I have confidence. Everything is balancing out."
He leaned toward me and tapped me on the chest in a most unpleasant way.
"Depend upon it, you can't defy the laws of probability." He spent the entire meal lecturing me on the laws of probability, concerning which, I am sure, he actually knew as little as you do. I finally said, "Surely all this gives you more writing time." "Obviously," he said. "I estimate that my writing time has increased by 20%. "And your output has gone up correspondingly, I imagine." "Well," he said, a little uncomfortably, "not just yet, I'm afraid. Naturally, I have to adjust. I'm not quite used to getting things done so quickly. It took me by surprise." Frankly, he didn't look surprised to me. He lifted his hand and, without looking, plucked the bill from the fingers of the waiter who was just approaching with it. He glanced at it cursorily and handed it back, with a credit card, to the waiter who had actually waited for it and who then left on the double. The entire dinner had taken a little over 30 minutes. I will not hide from you the fact that I would have preferred a civilized 2.5 hours, with champagne preceding, brandy succeeding, a fine wine or two separating the courses, and cultured conversation filling all the interstices. However, on the bright side was the fact that Mordecai had saved 2 hours, which he could spend money-grubbing for himself, and, to an extent, for me. As it happened, I didn't see Mordecai for 3 weeks or so after that dinner. I don't remember why that was, but I rather suspect it was one of those occasions in which we took turns being out of town. At any rate, I was just emerging one morning from a coffee shop at which I sometimes partake of a roll and scrambled eggs, when I saw Mordecai standing at the corner about half a block away. It was a miserable day of wet snow, the kind of day on which empty taxis approach you only in order to send a spray of dark gray slush over your pants legs as they shoot past you and turn on their off-duty signs. Mordecai had his back to me and was just raising his hand when an empty taxi rolled cautiously toward him. To my astonishment, Mordecai looked away. The taxi lingered, then crawled off, disappointment written across the face of its windshield. Mordecai raised his hand a second time, and from nowhere at all, a second taxi appeared and stopped for him. He got in, but as I could clearly hear, even from a distance of 40 yards, he did so with a ringing set of expletives not fit to be heard by anyone of tender upbringing, assuming that any such remain in the city. I phoned him later that morning and arranged to have cocktails with him at a friendly bar we knew that featured one happy hour after another the whole day long. I could hardly wait, for I simply had to have an explanation from him. What I wanted to know was the meaning of the expletives he used. "No, old fellow, I don't mean the dictionary meaning of the words, assuming they can be found in the dictionary. I meant why he should have used them at all. By all rights, he should have been ecstatically happy. When he entered the bar, he was not looking noticeably happy. In fact, he looked distinctly haggard. He said, 'Signal for the waitress, will you, George?' It was one of those bars where the waitresses were dressed without any undue regard for warmth, which, of course, helped keep me warm. I signaled for one gladly, even though I knew she would interpret my gestures as merely signifying a desire to place an order for a drink. In actual fact, she didn't interpret it at all, for she ignored me by keeping her very bare back firmly to me. I said, 'Really, Mordecai, if you want service, you'll have to signal yourself. The laws of probability have not yet bestirred themselves on my behalf, which is a shame, for it is long past time for my rich uncle to die and to disinherit his son in my favor.' 'You have a rich uncle?' asked Mordecai with a flicker of interest. 'No, and that only makes the whole thing even more unjust. Signal for a drink, will you, Mordecai?' 'The hell with it,' said Mordecai grumpily. 'Let them wait.' It was not them waiting that bothered me, of course, but my curiosity overcame my thirst. 'Mordecai,' I said, 'you seem unhappy. In fact, although you didn't see me this a.m., I saw you. You actually ignored an empty taxi on a day when they were worth their weight in gold, and then swore somewhat when you took a second.' Mordecai said, 'Is that so? Well, I'm tired of those bastards. Taxis haunt me. They follow me around in long lines. I can't as much as look toward the oncoming traffic without one of them stopping. I'm hovered over by crowds of waiters. Shopkeepers open closed stores at my approach. Every elevator flings itself wide as soon as I enter a building and waits for me stolidly at whatever floor I'm at. At every conceivable business office, I am instantly waved through the reception area by grinning hordes of receptionists. Minor functionaries at every level of government exist only to—' By then I had caught my breath. But, Mordecai, I said, this is splendid good fortune. The laws of probability... What he suggested I do to the laws of probability was entirely impossible, of course, since they are abstractions without corporeal parts. But, Mordecai, I expostulated, all this goes to increase your writing time.
It does not, said Mordecai forcefully. I can't write at all.
Why not, for heaven's sake?
Because I have lost thinking time.
You have lost what? I asked faintly.
All this waiting I have had to do, on lines, on street corners, in outer offices, was when I thought, when I figured out what I was going to write. It was my all-important preparation time.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either, but I know it now.
I said, I thought you spent all such waiting time fuming and swearing and eating your heart out.
Part of the time was spent that way. The rest of the time I spent thinking. And even the time that I spent railing at the injustice of the universe was useful, for it revved me up and set all my hormones frawling through my bloodstream, so that when I did reach my typewriter, I let all my frustrations boil off in one great and forceful banging at its keys. My thinking supplied my intellectual motivation, and my anger supplied my emotional motivation. Together they resulted in huge blocks of excellent writing pouring out of the dark and infernal fires of my soul. Now what have I got? Watch.
He clicked thumb and middle finger softly, and at once a gorgeously unapparelled damsel was within hand reach, saying, May I serve you, sir? Of course she could, but Mordecai merely ordered disconsolate drinks for the two of us.
I thought, he said, it was merely a matter of getting adjusted to the new situation. But I know now that no adjustment is possible.
You can refuse to take advantage of the situation as it is offered to you.
Can I? You saw me this morning. If I refuse a taxi, it just means another comes. I can refuse 50 times, and there'll be one waiting on the 51st occasion. They wear me out.
Well, then, why can't you simply reserve an hour or two every day for thinking time in the comfort of your office?
Exactly. In the comfort of my office. I can only think well when I am shifting from foot to foot on a street corner, or sitting on a granite chair in a drafty waiting room, or hungering in an unserviced dining room. I need the impetus of outrage.
But are you not outraged now?
It's not the same thing. One can be outraged at injustice, but how can one be outraged at everyone's being too kind and thoughtful to you, the insensitive louts? I am not outraged now. I am merely sad, and I can't write at all when I am sad.
We sat through the most unhappy happy hour I have ever encountered.
I swear to you, George, said Mordecai, I think I have been cursed. I think that some fairy godmother, furious at having not been invited to my christening, has finally found the one thing worse than being forced into unwanted delay at every turn. She has found the curse of total subservience to one's wishes.
At the sight of his misery, a not unmanly tear rose to my eye at the thought that I was myself none other than the fairy godmother he referred to, and that somehow he might find this out. After all, if he did, he might in his despair kill himself, or, far worse, me. Then came the ultimate horror. Having called for the bill, and of course receiving it at once, he studied it with lackluster eye, tossed it to me, and said with a hollow, hacking laugh, Here, you pay for it. I'm going home. I paid. What choice had I? But it left a wound I still feel on damp days. After all, is it right that I had shortened the lifetime of the sun by 2.5 million years just so that I would have to pay for drinks? Is that justice? I never saw Mordecai again. I heard, eventually, that he had left the country and had become a beachcomber somewhere in the South Seas. I don't know exactly what a beachcomber does, but I suspect they don't get wealthy at it. However, I am quite sure that if he is on the beach and should want a wave would come at once. By now, our bill had been brought by a sneering flunky, and it lay between us, while George ignored it with the flair he usually brings to such a performance. I said, You're not thinking of having Azazel do anything for me, George, are you? Not really, said George. Unfortunately, old fellow, you are not the kind of person whom one thinks of in connection with good deeds. Then you'll do nothing for me?
Not a thing.
Good, I said. Then I'll pay the check. It's the least you can do, said George. Dashing through the snow. George and I were sitting at the window of La Bohème, a French restaurant he patronized now and then at my expense, and I said, It will probably snow. That was not a great contribution to the world's store of knowledge. It had been dark and lowering all day. The temperature was in the teens, and the weatherman had predicted snow. Still, it hurt my feelings to have George ignore the remark entirely. He said, Now consider my friend Septimus Johnson. Why? I said. What has he to do with the fact that it will probably snow? A natural progression of ideas, said George severely. That is a process you must have heard others mention, even if you have never experienced it yourself. My friend Septimus, said George, was a ferocious young man, with a face permanently creased into a scowl and biceps permanently swollen into bulges. He was the seventh child in his family, hence his name. He had a younger brother named Octavius and a younger sister named Nina. I don't know how far the progression went, but I believe it was the crowded condition of his youthful days that made him strangely enamored of silence and solitude in his later years. Once he matured and achieved a certain success with his novels, like you, old fellow, except that the critics say rather flattering things about his work on occasion, he found himself with enough money to pamper his perversion. In short, he bought an isolated house on a forgotten piece of territory in upstate New York and retired there for longer or shorter periods in order to write further novels. It was not terribly far from civilization, but as far as the eye could see, at least, it seemed untamed wilderness. I think I was the only person he ever voluntarily invited to stay with him at his country place. I assume he found himself attracted by the calm dignity of my demeanor and the fascination and variety of my conversation. At least, he never explained the source of attraction in so many words, but it can scarcely have been anything else. One had to be careful with him, of course. Anyone who has ever felt the friendly clap on the back that is Septimus Johnson's favorite mode of greeting knows what it is to have a cracked vertebra. Still, his casual exertion of force came in handy at our first meeting. I had been beset by a dozen or two hoodlums, who were misled by my upper-class carriage and appearance into assuming I carried untold wealth in cash and jewels on my person. I defended myself furiously, for, as it happened, I did not have a penny on me that day, and I knew that the hoodlums, once they found this out, would, in their natural disappointment, use me with the utmost barbarity. It was at this point that Septimus appeared, lost in thought over something he was writing. The horde of wretches were in his way, and since he was too wrapped in thought to consider walking in anything but a straight line, he tossed them absently to one side or the other in twos and threes. He happened to come upon me at the bottom of the pile just as light dawned, and he saw a way out of his literary dilemma, whatever it was. Feeling me to be a good luck charm, he invited me to dinner. Feeling dinner at another's expense to be an even better luck charm, I accepted. By the time dinner was over, I had established the kind of ascendancy over him that led to my being invited to his country place. Such invitations were repeated frequently. As he said at one time, being with me was as close to being alone as possible, and considering how he loved solitude, that was quite obviously a great compliment. At first I expected a hovel, but I was quite wrong. Septimus had clearly done well with his novels, and he had spared no expense. I know it is rather unkind to speak of successful novels in your presence, old man, but I am, as always, wedded to the facts. The house, in fact, although isolated to the point of keeping me in a permanent state of horripilation, was thoroughly electrified, with an oil-fired generator in the basement and solar panels on the roof. We ate well, and he had a magnificent wine cellar. We lived in total luxury, something to which I have always been able to adapt myself with astonishing ease, considering my lack of practice. To be sure, it was impossible to avoid looking out the windows altogether, and the total lack of scenery was remarkably depressing. There were, if you can credit it, hills and fields and a small lake and incredible quantities of vegetation of a bilious green, but not a sign of human habitation, of highways, or of anything else worth looking at, not as much as a line of telephone poles. Once, after a good meal and good wine, Septimus said expansively,
George, I find it pleasant to have you here. After listening to you, I find it such a relief to turn to my word processor that my writing has improved substantially. Do feel free to come here at any time. Here, he waved his hand about, you can escape from all your cares and all the annoyances that may be hounding you. And when I am at work at my word processor, you have free access to my books, to the television set, to the refrigerator, and I believe you know the location of the wine cellar. As it happened, I did. I had even drawn a little map of guidance for myself, with a large X at the site of the wine cellar and several alternative routes carefully plotted out. The only thing is, said Septimus, this refuge from worldly woe is closed from 1st December to 31st March. I cannot offer you my hospitality then. I must remain in my townhouse. I was rather dashed at this. Snow time was woe time for me. After all, my dear fellow, it is in winter that my creditors are most pressing. These grasping people who, as everyone knows, are wealthy enough to be able to ignore the few paltry pennies I may owe them, seem to gain a kind of special delight at the thought that I might be thrown out into the snow. It inspires them to new feats of wolfish greed, so that it was then above all I would have welcomed refuge. I said, "Why not use it in winter, Septimus? With a roaring fire in this magnificent fireplace, ably abetting your equally magnificent central heating system, you could laugh at the cold of Antarctica." "So I could," said Septimus. "But it seems that each winter howling devils of blizzards converge here and dump snow on this demi-paradise of mine. This house, lost in the solitude I adore, is then cut off from the outside world." "The world is well lost," I pointed out. "You are perfectly right," said Septimus. "And yet my supplies come from the outside world. Food, drink, fuel, laundry. It is humiliating but true that I cannot actually survive without the outside world. At least I couldn't live the kind of sybaritic life that any decent human being would want to live." I said, "You know, Septimus, it may be that I can think of a way out of this." "Think away," he said, "but you won't succeed. Still, this home is yours 8 months of the year, or at least whenever I am here during those 8 months." It was true, but how could a reasonable man settle for 8 months when 12 months existed? That evening I called up Azazel. I don't think you know about Azazel. He is a demon, a magical imp about 2 centimeters high, who possesses extraordinary power, which he is glad to exhibit, because back in his own world, wherever that may be, he is not very highly thought of. Consequently... Oh, you have heard of him. Well, really, old fellow, how can I tell you this story in reasoned manner if you feel called upon to insert your own views continually? You don't seem to realize that the art of the true conversationalist consists of being completely attentive and refraining from interruption on such specious excuses as that of having heard it all before. At any rate, Azazel was, as always, furious at being called up. Apparently, he was engaged in what he called a solemn religious observance. I held my own temper with difficulty. He is always involved in something he imagines to be important, and never seems to stop to consider that when I call him up, I am invariably involved in something that is important. I waited calmly till his twittering sputters died out, and then I explained the situation. He listened with a scowl on his tiny face and said at last, "What is snow?" I sighed and explained. "You mean solidified water falls from the sky here? Chunks of solidified water? And life survives?" I didn't bother to mention hail, but said, "It falls as soft downy flakes, mighty one." It always soothed him, you see, to call him foolish names. "It is inconvenient, however, when it falls to excess." Azazel said, "If you are going to ask me to rearrange the weather pattern in this world, then I refuse with considerable fervor. That would come under the heading of planet tampering, which is against the ethics of my highly ethical people. I would not dream of being unethical, especially since if I were caught at it, I would be fed to the dread Lamel bird, a most filthy creature with dreadful table manners. I would hate to tell you what he'd mix me with." "I wouldn't dream of having you planet temper, sublime one. I would like to ask something much simpler. You see, snow, when it falls,
is so soft and downy that it will not support the weight of a human being.
It is your fault for being so massive, said Azazel scornfully.
No doubt, I said, but this mass makes the going difficult. I would like to make my friend less heavy when he is on snow. It was hard for me to hold Azazel's attention. He kept saying, in a revolted manner,
solidified water, all over, burying the land.
He shook his head as though unable to grasp the concept. Can you make my friend less heavy? I asked, pounding away at what was, after all, a very simple point.
Of course, said Azazel indignantly. All it requires is the application of the anti-gravity principle, activated by the water molecule under appropriate conditions. It isn't easy, but it can be done.
Wait, I said uneasily, thinking of the dangers of inflexibility. It would be wise to place the anti-gravitational intensity under my friend's control. He might find it convenient to flounder on occasion.
Fit it to your crude autonomic system? Really, you know no limits to your effrontery.
I only ask, I said, because it's you. I would know better than to ask this of any other of your species. This diplomatic untruth had its expected effect. Azazel expanded his chest by 2 full millimeters, and in a lordly countertenor squeak said,
It shall be done.
I supposed Septimus gained the ability at that moment, but I couldn't be sure. It was August at the time, and there was no snow cover with which to experiment. Nor was I in the mood for a quick trip to Antarctica, Patagonia, or even Greenland in a search for experimental material. Nor was there any point in explaining the situation to Septimus without snow for demonstration. He would not have believed me. He might even have come to the ridiculous conclusion that I had been drinking. But the fates were kind. I was at Septimus's country home in late November, in what he called his farewell stay for the season, and there was a copious fall of snow, unusually heavy for the month. Septimus chafed loudly and proclaimed war on the universe for not having spared him this vile insult. But it was heaven to me, and to him did he but know. I said, Fear not, Septimus. Now is the time for you to find out that snow has no terrors for you. And I explained the situation in ample detail. I suppose it was to be expected that his first reaction would be one of ribald disbelief, but he made certain totally unnecessary animadversions on the state of my mental health. However, I had had months to work out my strategy. I said, You may have wondered, Septimus, how I earn my living. You will not be surprised at my reticence when I tell you that I am the key figure in a government research program on anti-gravity. I can say no more, except that you are an invaluable experiment and will greatly advance the program. This has important national security implications. He stared at me in wide-eyed amazement as I softly hummed a few bars of the Star-Spangled Banner. Are you serious? He asked. Would I palter with the truth? I asked in my turn. Then, risking the natural rejoinder, I said, Would the CIA? He swallowed it, overcome by the aura of simple veracity that pervades all my statements. He said, What am I supposed to do? I said, There's only 6 inches of snow on the ground. Imagine yourself to be weighing nothing and step out on it. I just have to imagine it? That's the way it works. I'll get my feet wet. I said sarcastically, Put on your hip boots, then. He hesitated, and then actually got out his hip boots and struggled into them. This open show of lack of faith in my statements hurt me deeply. In addition, he put on a furry overcoat and an even furrier hat. If you're ready, I said coldly. I'm not, he said. I opened the door and he stepped out. There was no snow on the covered veranda, but as soon as he placed his feet on the steps, they seemed to slide out from under him. He grabbed the balustrade with a desperate grip. He had somehow reached the bottom of the short flight of steps, and he tried to push himself upright. It didn't work, at least not in the way he intended. He went sliding along for a few feet, arms flailing, and then his feet went up in the air. He came down on his back and continued to slide until he passed a young tree and wrapped an arm around the trunk. He slid around it 3 or 4 times and came to a halt.
"What kind of slippery snow do we have here?"
he shouted in a voice that trembled with indignation. I must admit that despite my faith in Azazel, I found myself staring in surprise. He had left no footprints, and his sliding body had made no furrow in the snow. I said, "You don't weigh anything on the snow."
"Lunatic," he said.
I said, "Look at the snow. You've left no marks." He stared, then made a few cursory remarks of the type that in past years used to be referred to as unprintable. "And," I went on, "friction depends in part on the pressure between a sliding body and what it slides upon. The lower the pressure, the less the friction. You weigh nothing, so your pressure on the snow is zero. The friction is zero, and you therefore slide on snow as though it were the smoothest ice."
"What am I supposed to do, then? I can't have my feet slide out on me like that."
"It doesn't hurt, does it? If you don't weigh anything and you land on your back, it doesn't hurt."
"Even so, not being hurt is insufficient excuse for spending my life on my back in the snow."
"Come, Septimus, think yourself heavy again, and then get up." He scowled in his usual fashion and said,
"Just think myself heavy, eh?"
But he did, and got clumsily to his feet. He stood inches deep in it now, and when he tried, cautiously, to walk, he had no more trouble than one usually does in snow.
"How do you do it, George?"
he said, with much more respect in his voice than I usually manage to elicit.
"I wouldn't have thought you were such a scientist."
"The CIA forces me to mask my keen scientific know-how," I explained. "Now imagine yourself lighter, little by little, and walk as you do it. You'll leave shallower and shallower tracks, and the snow will grow more and more slippery. Stop when you feel it becoming dangerously slippery." He did as he was told, for we scientists have a strong intellectual grip over lesser mortals. "Now," I said, "try sliding around. When you want to stop, just make yourself heavier, and do it gradually or you'll go over on your nose." He caught the knack immediately, being the athletic type. He told me once he could do anything in the way of sport but swim. His father, when he was a boy of 3, had tossed him into the water in a kindly attempt to get him to swim without the tedious necessity of instruction, and the young Septimus had required 10 minutes of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as a result. He said it had left him with a lifetime fear of water and an aversion to snow as well.
"Snow is just solid water," he said,
exactly as Azazel would have. The aversion to snow failed to make itself evident under the new conditions, however. He began sliding about with an ear-splitting whee, and would, from time to time, make himself heavier as he turned, casting up a thick spray of snow and coming to a halt. He said, "Wait," dashed into the house, and emerged, if you will believe it, with ice skates affixed to boots.
"I learned how to skate on my lake," he explained as he began to put them on, "but I never enjoyed it. I was always afraid the ice would break. Now I can skate on land without danger."
"But remember," I said anxiously, "it only works above the H2O molecule. If you come to a bare patch of earth or exposed pavement, your lightness will vanish instantly. You'll hurt yourself."
"Don't worry,"
he said, getting to his feet and taking off. I watched him speed along for at least 0.5 mile over the frozen wastes of his acreage, and to my ears there came the distant bellow of,
"Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh."
Septimus, you must understand, guesses at the pitch of each note, and always guesses wrong. I put my hands over my ears. There followed what I truly believe was the happiest winter of my life. All winter long I was snug and warm in the house, eating and drinking like a king, reading improving books in which I tried to outguess the author and identify the murderer, and speculating with grim delight on the frustrations of my creditors back in the city. Through the window I could watch Septimus in his endless skating over the snow. He said it made him feel like a bird and gave him a 3-dimensional delight he had never known.
Well, to each his own. I did warn him he must not let himself be seen. It would endanger me, I said, for the CIA would not approve this private experimentation. But I don't care about my personal danger, for, to a person like myself, science comes above all. However, if you were ever seen skimming over snow as you do, you would become an object of curiosity, and dozens of newspapermen would swarm over you. The CIA would hear of it, and you would have to undergo experimentation with hundreds of scientists and military men poking at you. You would never be alone for a minute. You would become a national celebrity, and you would be at all times within reach of thousands of people concerned over you. Septimus shuddered strongly at the prospect, as I knew an isolation lover would have to. Then he said, "But how will I get supplies when I am snowed in? That was the whole purpose of this experiment." I said, "I'm sure the trucks will almost always be able to make their way up the roads, and you can store up enough to tide you over those times when they can't. If you do need something on an emergency basis when you are truly snowed in, you can skim as close to town as you dare, making sure no one sees you. There'll be very few people in the open at such times anyway, possibly no one. Then restore your weight, tramp the last few hundred feet, and look worn out. Pick up what you need, tramp away a few hundred feet, and take off again. See?" Actually, it was never necessary to do that even once during that winter. I knew all along that he had exaggerated the snow danger, and no one ever saw him during his skimming either. Septimus couldn't get enough. You should have seen his face when snow held off for more than a week or the temperature rose above freezing. You can't imagine how he feared for the safety of the snow cover. What a marvelous winter! What a tragedy that it was the only one! What happened? I'll tell you what happened. You remember what Romeo said just before he slipped the knife into Juliet? You probably don't, so I'll tell you. He said, "Let a woman in your life and your serenity is through." The following fall, Septimus met a woman, Mercedes Gum. He had met women before. He was no anchorite, but they had never meant much to him. A short period of socialization, romance, ardor, and then he forgot them, and they him. No harm in it. After all, I myself have been ferociously pursued by many young women, and I never found harm in it at all, even though they frequently cornered me and forced me to... But I drift away from the story. Septimus came to me in a very cast-down mood. "I love her, George," he said. "I am driven to distraction by her. She is the very lodestone of my existence." "Very pretty," I said. "You have my permission to carry on with her for a while."
"Thanks, George," said Septimus gloomily. "Now what I need is her approval. I don't know why it should be, but she doesn't seem to take to me much."
"Odd," I said. "You are usually quite successful with women. You are, after all, rich, muscular, and not uglier than most."
"I think it's the muscular part," said Septimus. "She thinks I'm an oaf."
I had to admire Miss Gum's perception. Septimus, to put it as kindly as possible, was an oaf. I thought it best, however, as I imagined his biceps writhing under his jacket sleeves, not to mention my estimate of the situation. He said,
"She says she doesn't admire the physical in men. She wants someone thoughtful, intellectual, deeply rational, philosophical, and a whole bucketful of adjectives like those. She says I'm not any of these things."
"Have you told her you're a novelist?"
"Of course I've told her that. And she's read a couple of novels of mine, too. But you know, George, they tend to be about football players, and she says she found that revolting."
"I take it she's not the athletic type."
"Certainly not. She swims."
And he made a face, probably remembering being mouth-to-mouth resuscitated at the tender age of 3.
"But that doesn't help."
"In that case," I said consolingly, "forget her, Septimus. Women are easy to come by. As one leaves, another arrives. There are many fish in the sea and birds in the air. They are all alike in the dark. One woman or another, it makes no difference." I would have continued indefinitely, but he seemed to grow oddly restless as he listened, and one doesn't care to make an oaf restless. Septimus said,
"George, you offend me deeply with those sentiments. Mercedes is the only girl in the world for me. I couldn't live without her. She is inseparably bonded to the core of my being. She is the very breath of my lungs, the beat of my heart, the vision of my eyes. She...
He did continue indefinitely, and it didn't seem to bother him in the least that he was offending me deeply with those sentiments. He said,
"So I see no way out but of insisting on marriage."
The words were the knell of doom. I knew exactly what the result would be. As soon as they were married, that would mean the end of my paradise. I don't know why it is, but if there is one thing that new wives insist upon, it is that bachelor friends must go. I would never be invited to Septimus's country place again.
"You can't do that," I said in alarm.
"Oh, I admit it seems hard, but I think I can do it. I have worked out a plan. Mercedes may think I'm an oaf, but I'm not entirely unintellectual. I will invite her to my country place at the beginning of winter. There, in the quiet and peace of my Eden, she will feel her being expand, and she will come to realize the true beauty of my soul."
That, I thought, was expecting far too much even of Eden. But what I said was,
"You're not planning to show her how you can skim over the snow, are you?"
"No, no," he said. "Not until we're married."
"Even then..."
"Nonsense, George," said Septimus censoriously. "A wife is a husband's second self. A wife can be trusted with the dearest secrets of one's soul. A wife..."
Again, he went on indefinitely, and all I could do was say weakly, "The CIA won't like it." His brief comment on the CIA was one with which the Soviets would hardly have agreed. Cuba and Nicaragua as well.
"Somehow I'll persuade her to come with me at the beginning of December," he said. "I trust you will understand, George, if we two plan to be alone. I know you wouldn't dream of interfering with the romantic possibilities that would arise between Mercedes and myself in the peaceful solitude of nature. We would surely be drawn together by the magnetism of silence and slow time."
I recognized the quotation, of course. It was what Macbeth said just before he slipped the knife into Duncan. But I merely stared at Septimus in a cold and dignified way. A month later, then, Miss Gum did go to Septimus's country place, and I did not. What happened at the country place, I did not witness. I know it only through the spoken testimony of Septimus, so I cannot vouch for all the details. Miss Gum was a swimmer, but Septimus, feeling an unconquerable aversion to that particular hobby, asked no questions about it. Nor did Miss Gum apparently feel it necessary to force detail on an unquestioning oaf. For that reason, Septimus never found out that Miss Gum was one of those mad women who enjoyed donning a bathing suit in the depth of winter, breaking the ice in the lake, and dropping into the freezing water for a healthful, invigorating swim. It followed that one bright and frosty morning, while Septimus was snoring in oafish slumber, Miss Gum arose, put on her bathing suit, terry cloth cloak, and sneakers, and went along the snow-covered path to the lake. The rim was lightly iced up, but the interior was still free of cover, and removing the cloak and sneakers, she plunged into the frigid water with what must have been every evidence of enjoyment. It was not long after that that Septimus awoke, and with a lover's fine instinct, instantly realized that his beloved Mercedes was not in the house. He went through it, calling her name. Finding her clothes and other belongings in her room, he realized she had not secretly left for the city, as had been his first fearful thought. She must then be outside. Hastily, he put boots on his bare feet and slipped his heaviest overcoat over his pajamas. He dashed outside, calling her name. Miss Gum heard him, of course, and waved her arms madly in his direction, shouting, "Right here, Sep, right here!" What followed next, I'll tell you in Septimus's own words. He said,
"To me it sounded like, 'Here, help, help!'"
I reached the natural conclusion that my love had ventured out onto the ice in a moment of madness and had fallen in. How could it ever occur to me that she would willingly throw herself into freezing water? Such was my great love for her, George, that I instantly determined to dare the water which ordinarily I cravenly feared, especially ice-cold water, and to rush to her rescue. Well, perhaps not instantly, but honestly, it was after not more than 2 minutes of thought, or three at the outside. Then I shouted, "I'm coming, my own, my loved one. Keep your head above water." And I started out. I wasn't going to walk there through the snow. I felt there wasn't enough time. I decreased my weight as I ran, and then took off on a magnificent slide right across the shallow snow cover, right across the ice that rimmed the lake, and right into the water with a horrendous splash. As you know, I can't swim, and am indeed deadly afraid of water. My boots and overcoat dragged me down, too, and I would certainly have drowned if Mercedes had not rescued me. You would think that the romance of rescuing me would have drawn us closer together, welded us into one, but...
Septimus shook his head, and there were tears in his eyes.
It didn't work that way. She was furious.
"You oaf!" she shrieked. "Imagine plunging into the water in your overcoat and boots and not even being able to swim. What on earth did you think you were doing? Do you know what a struggle it was to get you out of the lake? And you were in such a panic you clipped me on the jaw. You nearly knocked me out and had us both drown. And it still hurts."
She packed and left in a complete huff, and I had to remain behind with something that quickly developed into a very nasty cold, one I still haven't quite gotten over yet. I haven't seen her since then. She won't answer my letters. She won't return my phone calls. My life is over, George.
I said, "Just out of curiosity, Septimus, why did you throw yourself into the water? Why didn't you stand on the lake shore, or as far out on the ice as you dared, and reach a long stick out to her, or throw her a rope if you could get one?" Septimus looked aggrieved.
"I didn't intend to throw myself into the water. I intended to slide along the top."
"Slide along the top? Didn't I tell you your weightlessness would only work on ice?"
Septimus's look became one of ferocity. "I thought that was it. You said it only worked on H2O. That includes water, doesn't it?"
He was right. H2O sounded more scientific, and I had to maintain my air of scientific genius. I said, "But I meant solid H2O.
"But you didn't say solid H2O,
he said, as he slowly rose with what I felt to be the clear intention of dismembering me. I didn't remain to check on the accuracy of my feeling. I have never seen him since, nor have I ever again been to his country paradise. I believe he lives on a South Sea island now, largely, I think, because he never wants to see ice or snow again. It's as I say, let a woman in your life... Though, come to think of it, it may have been Hamlet who said that just before he slipped his knife into Ophelia. George let a large, vinous sigh bubble forth from the depths of what he considers his soul, and said, "But they're closing the place, and we had better leave. Have you paid the bill?" "Unfortunately, I had." "And can you lend me a fiver, old man, to get me home?" "Even more unfortunately, I could." Logic is logic. George was not one of those craven souls who felt that the fact that he was not paying for a meal deprived him of the right to criticize it. He expressed his disappointment to me, therefore, with as much delicacy as he could, or as much as he thought I deserved, which is not quite the same thing, of course. "This smorgasbord," he said, "is distinctly inferior. The meatballs are not hot enough. The herring is not salty enough. The shrimp are not crisp enough. The cheese is not sharp enough. The deviled eggs are not peppery enough. I said, "George, that's the third heaping plate you've devoured. One more bite and you will have to undergo surgery to release the gastric pressure. Why are you eating so much of this inferior material?" George said haughtily, "Is it for me to humiliate my host by refusing to eat his food?" "It's not my food, it's the restaurant's. The owner of this miserable hovel is he to whom I am referring. Tell me, old man, why don't you belong to some good club? I pay enormous sums for dubious returns? I mean a good club, which I can then grace as your guest in return for a sumptuous meal. But no," he added querulously, "that is a mad dream. What good club would compromise its position by allowing you to be a member? Any club that would allow you as a guest would certainly allow me," I began, but George was already lost in reminiscence. I remember, he said, eyes glistening, when I dined at least once a month at a club that featured the most lavish and the most intricate buffet that ever graced any groaning board since the days of Lucullus. I presume you freeloaded as someone's guest. I don't know that that is a necessary presumption, but by sheer chance you happen to be correct. It was Alistair Tobago Crump the Sixth who was actually the member, and, which is more important, my occasional host. George, I said, is this going to be another story in which you and Azazel combine to hurl some poor soul down a declivity of misery and despair in your misguided efforts to help him? I don't know what you mean. We granted him his heart's desire out of sheer kindness and the abstract love of humanity, and my somewhat more concrete love of the buffet. But let me tell you the story from the beginning. Alistair Tobago Crump the Sixth had been a member of the Eden from birth, for his father, Alistair Tobago Crump the Fifth, entered his son's name on the rolls as soon as a personal inspection assured him that the doctor's initial estimate of the infant's sex had been correct. Alistair Tobago Crump the Fifth had similarly been entered by his father, and so on back to the days when Bill Crump, while sleeping off a drunken stupor, had been pressed into the British Navy just in time to find himself an indignant member of the crew of one of the ships of the fleet that captured New Amsterdam from the Dutch in 1664. The Eden, as it happens, is the most exclusive club on the North American continent. So haughty is it that its very existence is known only to its members and a very few guests. Even I do not know its location, for I was always taken there blindfolded in a handsome cab with opaque windows. I can only tell you that for a period of time during the final approach, the horse's hooves passed over a stretch of cobbled road. No one could belong to the Eden whose ancestry did not extend into the colonial period on both sides of the family. Nor is it ancestry alone that counts. There must be no smudge on the escutcheon. George Washington was blackballed by unanimous vote, since he had undeniably rebelled against his sovereign lord. This same requirement was maintained for any guests, but that did not exclude me, of course. Unlike you, I am not a first-generation immigrant from Dobrija or Herzegovina or some equally unlikely place. My ancestry is impeccable, since all my forebears have infested the territory of this nation since the 17th century, and since they, one and all, avoided the sins of rebellion, disloyalty, and un-Americanism during the Revolutionary and Civil Wars by cheering both sides impartially as their armies marched past. My friend Alistair was inordinately proud of his own membership. Many a time and oft did he say to me, for he was one of your classic bores and frequently repeated himself, George, the Eden is the bone and sinew of my being, the core of my existence. If I had all that wealth and power could bring me, and had not Eden, I would be as naught. Of course, Alistair did have all that wealth and power could bring him, for another requirement for membership at the Eden was great wealth. The annual dues, if nothing else, made that imperative. And again, that in itself was not enough. The wealth had to be inherited. It could not be earned. Any trace of actually working in return for payment made one clearly ineligible for membership. It was only because my father had thoughtlessly forgotten to leave me several millions of dollars that kept me out of the club, even though I had never undergone the disgrace of working for... Don't say I know that, old man. There's no way you could know that. Naturally, there was no objection to a member's augmenting his income by interesting methods that did not involve labor for pay. There were always such things as stock manipulation, tax evasion, influence peddling, and other clever devices that come as second nature to the rich. This was all taken seriously by members of Eden. There had been cases of Edenites who, having lost their money through unaccountable attacks of momentary honesty, preferred to starve slowly to death rather than go to work and lose their membership. Their names are still mentioned in hushed tones, and plaques in their honor are to be found in the clubhouse. No, they couldn't borrow money from fellow members, old man. It's so like you to suggest that. Every member of Eden knows you don't borrow from a rich man when there are uncounted numbers of poor people waiting anxiously in line for the chance to be defrauded. The Bible reminds us that ye have the poor with you always, and the members of Eden are nothing if not pious. And yet, Alistair was not entirely happy, for it is an unfortunate fact that the membership of the Eden tended to avoid him. I have told you he was a bore. He had no fund of conversation, no cleverness, no opinion of note. In fact, even in the midst of a membership whose total fund of wit and originality was on a fourth-grade grammar school level, he stood out as remarkably dull. You can imagine his frustration as he sat there night after night at the Eden, alone amidst the crowd. The ocean of conversation, such as it was, washed over him but left him dry. Yet he never missed a night at the club. He even had himself carried there during a violent attack of dysentery in order not to break his record as Iron Man Crump. This was abstractly admired by the membership, but for some reason not widely appreciated. To be sure, he had the occasional privilege of having me as his guest at the Eden. My ancestry was impeccable. My aristocratic record as a confirmed non-earner was the admiration of all. And in return for the finest of food and the most cobwebby of ambience, all at Crump's expense, I went to the trouble of talking to him and laughing at his perfectly terrible jokes. I found myself pitying the poor fellow from the very bottom of my capacious heart. Somehow, there ought to be some way of making him the life of the party, the toast of Eden, the man with whom every member longed to be. I pictured aged and respectable Edenites engaged in spavined fisticuffs for the honor of sitting next to him at the evening meal. After all, Alistair was the very picture of respectability, and all that an Edenite should be. He was tall, he was slim, his face had the look of a ruminative horse, he had lank blonde hair, pale blue eyes, and the dull look of formal conservative orthodoxy of a man whose ancestors had all thought sufficiently well of themselves to marry within the clan. All he lacked was any trace of anything in the least interesting to say or do. But that could surely be fixed. It was a case for Azazel. For once, Azazel was not annoyed with me for calling him forth from his mystical world. He had been at a banquet of sorts, it seemed, and it had been his turn to pick up the check, and I had pulled him away 5 minutes before that check was due to arrive. He chuckled in a falsetto ululation, for, as you know, he is only 2 centimeters high. He said,
"I will return 15 minutes later, and by that time someone else will have committed himself to pay that check."
I said, "How will you account for your absence?" He drew himself up to his full micro height, twitching his tail.
"I will tell them the truth, that I was called away to a conference with an extragalactic monster of extraordinary stupidity who was in dire need of my intelligence. What do you want this time?"
I told him, and to my amazement he burst into tears. At least, he sprayed tiny red spicules from his eyes. I suppose they were tears. One got into my mouth and tasted terrible, rather like cheap red wine, or like cheap red wine would taste if I ever allowed myself to taste it.
"How sad," he said. "I know the case of a worthy entity who is constantly snubbed by others who are far his inferiors. I find there is nothing more tragic."
"Who would that be? The entity snubbed, that is."
"I,"
he said, thumping his tiny chest till it squeaked. "I can't imagine that," I said. "You?"
"I can't either," he said. "But it's true just the same. What does this friend of yours do that shows any promise?"
"Well, he does tell jokes. Or he tries to. They're awful. He drones them out, circles the point aimlessly, then forgets it. I have frequently seen a joke of his make a strong man weep." Azazel shook his head.
"Bad, very bad. Now, I happen to be an excellent joke spinner. Did I ever tell you about the time a Plox and a Jinaram were engaged in mutual andisantori, and one of them said..."
"Yes, you did," I said, lying strenuously. "But let us get on to the case of Crump." Azazel said,
"Is there any simple technique that can improve the telling of a joke?"
A certain glibness, of course, I said.
Of course, said Azazel. A mere divalination of the vocal cords could take care of that, assuming you barbarians have such things.
We do. And then, of course, the ability to handle an accent.
An accent?
Substandard English. Foreigners who have not learned the language as infants, but who pick it up in later life, invariably mispronounce the vowels, miss out on word order, break up the grammar, and so on. A look of sheer horror crossed Azazel's tiny face.
But that's a capital offense, he said.
Not on this world, I said. It should be, but it isn't. Azazel shook his head sadly.
Has this friend of yours ever heard these atrocities you call accents?
Certainly. Anyone living in New York hears accents of all types at all times. It is correct English such as my own that one hardly ever hears.
Ah, said Azazel. It is then only a matter of scapulating the memory.
What, the memory?
Scapulate. A form of sharpening from the word scapos, referring to the teeth of a zum-eating dirigen.
And that will make it possible for him to tell jokes with an accent?
Only with those accents he has happened to hear in the course of his life. My powers, after all, are not unlimited.
Then scapulate away. A week later, I met Alistair Tobago Crump VI on Fifth Avenue and 53rd Street, and searched his face in vain for any signs of recent triumph. Alistair, I said, have you been telling any jokes lately?
George, he said, no one will listen. There are times when I think I don't tell jokes any better than the average man.
Well, then, I tell you what. You come with me to a small establishment I know. I will give you a humorous introduction, and then you stand up and say anything that's in your mind. I assure you, old man, it was not easy to persuade him to do this. I had to make use of the full force of my magnetic personality. In the end, though, I won out. I took him to a rather crummy dive I happen to know. I can describe it best by saying it is rather reminiscent of the places you take me to dinner. I also happened to know the manager of the dive, which was its great advantage, and I persuaded him to allow me to experiment. At 11 p.m., when revelry was at its height, I rose to my feet and cowed the audience with my air of dignity. There were only 11 people present, but I felt that was enough with which to experiment. "Ladies and gentlemen," I said, "we have in our presence a gentleman of great intellect, a master of our language, whom I'm sure you would all love to meet. He is Alistair Tobago Crump VI, and he is Emersonian professor of English at Columbia College and author of How to Speak Perfect English. Professor Crump, will you arise and say a few words to the assembled intellectuals, please?" Crump arose, looking rather confused, and said,
"Listen, thank you all very much."
"Well, old man, I've heard you tell jokes in what purports to be a Yiddish accent, but you could pass for a Harvard graduate in comparison to Crump. The thing is that Crump looked exactly as you would expect an Emersonian professor of English to look. And to stare at that woebegone, inbred face and suddenly hear a phrase in pure Yinglish knocked the breath out of every person there simultaneously. Such an aroma of alcoholic onions filled the air as you would not believe. And that was followed by a roar of laughter that built up into hysterics. A look of mild surprise crossed Crump's face. He said to me, in a beautiful Swedish sing-song which I won't try to reproduce, "I don't usually get quite this strong a reaction." "Never mind," I said. "Keep on talking." It meant waiting for the laughter to stop, which took a while. And then he began telling jokes in Irish brogues, in Scottish burrs, in Cockney, Middle European, Spanish, Greek. His specialty was clearly Brooklynese, however. Your own noble, nearly native tongue, old man. After that, I let him spend some hours at Eden every evening,
and after dinner I would take him to the establishment. Word of mouth spread the tale. That first night, as I said, the audience had been a sparse one, but in no time at all we had people outside clamoring to get in, and in vain. Crump took it calmly. In fact, he seemed downcast. He said, "Look, there's no point in wasting all this excellent material of mine on ordinary yokels. I want to show my skill to my fellow members of Eden. They wouldn't listen to my jokes because it had never occurred to me to tell them in dialect. In fact, I didn't realize I could, which just shows the unbelievable self-underestimation into which a quietly humorous and witty fellow such as myself can fall. Just because I am not raucous and do not push myself forward..." He was speaking in his best Brooklynese, which grates unpleasantly on any delicate ear, if you don't mind my saying so, old man, and so I hastened to assure him that I would take care of everything. I told the manager of the establishment of the wealth of the members of Eden, neglecting to mention that they were as parsimonious as they were rich. The manager, drooling slightly, sent out complimentary tickets to lure them in. This was on my advice, for I well knew that no true Edenite could resist a free show, especially as I carefully initiated a rumor that stag films would be shown. The membership showed up in force, and Crump expanded at the sight. "Now I can do it," he said. "I've got a Korean accent that will kill them." He also had a southern drawl and a Maine twang that had to be heard to be believed. The men of Eden, for a few minutes, sat in stony silence, and I had the terrible notion that they didn't understand Crump's subtle humor. But they were only paralyzed with astonishment, and as the astonishment wore off, they began to laugh. Portly belly shook, pince-nez fell off, white mutton chops waved in the breeze. Every possible disgusting sound, from the dry falsetto cackles of some to the oleaginous bass mumblings of others, that could serve to make life hideous, proceeded to do so. Crump expanded at this proper appreciation, and the manager, feeling certain that he was at the entrance gate to countless wealth, rushed up to Crump at the intermission and said, my boy, I know you asked only for the opportunity to display your art, and that you are and remain above the filth that people call money. But I can't allow that any longer. Call me foolish, call me mad, but here, here, my boy, take this check. You have earned it, every penny of it. Lavish it as you will. And with the generosity of the typical entrepreneur who expects millions in return, he pushed into Crump's hand a check for $25. Well, as I see it, that was the beginning. Crump went on into feigned satisfaction, the idol of the nightclub circuit, the admired of all beholders. Money poured in on him, and since he was wealthy beyond the dreams of Croesus, due to the industrious orphan defrauding of his ancestors, he needed none of it, and passed it all on to his business manager, in short, me. Within a year I was a millionaire, and so there goes your characteristically idiotic theory that the Zazzle and I bring only ill fortune. I stared at George sardonically. Since you are several $1 million short of being a millionaire, George, I presume you are now going to tell me it was all a dream. Not at all, said George haughtily. The story is perfectly true, as is every word I utter. And the ending I have just outlined is precisely what would have happened if Alistair Tobago Crump the Sixth had not been a fool. A fool, was he? Certainly. I leave it to you. Overcome by pride in the munificent $25 check he had received, he framed it, brought it to the Eden, and fatuously displayed it to all. What choice did the members have? He had earned money. He had been paid for his labors. They were forced to expel him. And Crump, deprived of his club, went to the injudicious length of having a fatal heart attack in consequence. Surely none of that was the fault of Azazel or myself. But if he framed the check, he wasn't really taking any money.
George raised a magisterial right hand as he shoved the bill for the evening meal in my direction with his left. It is the principle of the thing. I told you the Edenites were strong on religion. When Adam was expelled from Eden, God told him that from then on he would have to work in order to make a living. I think the exact words were, "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread." It follows then that, in reverse, if you work to make a living, you have to be expelled from Eden. Logic is logic.